video, as far as I'm concerned. I think you'd be a little feisty this noon, say nothing about that. So anyway, he did that. He got some CEOs of other Christian organizations together, and we learned from each other. Now, I thought about a pastor. You must be inundated with people who are very ready to tell you how to do your job. Man, the resources must be absolutely overwhelming. Kind of like, you know, God, I sometimes think, you know, God looked at man and he said, it's not good for man to be alone. I'll make a helpmeet for him. And I didn't know how much help I needed. People ask me, do you drive or does Lucy? Well, she drives, I steer. Well, you guys don't know how much help you need, I guess. So I'm not here as a consultant on church business. I've taught in the church a long time, been on church councils, etc., and I have a very great heart for the church ministry. I meet with my pastor for lunch once a month. But in no way, shape, or form am I here to make any suggestions or even answer any questions on how, you know, you can do things better in your church, because I don't know. But we do have a similar responsibility of spiritual leadership, whatever the structure may be that we're responsible for. And I thought I would just set a little tone for what our discussion might be, and you can shift it to wherever you want, because, yeah, we want to talk. But I also want to share something with you, just as a little thing to set the tone. There's always debate, it seems like, over a number of subjects. One is, what is leadership? There's the autocratic, democratic, laissez-faire, there's style, all kinds of stuff. Some years ago, I asked some navigators to form a task force to do an original biblical study on leadership. There have been a lot of those, as you know. Probably done them yourself. And they came up with something that sounded way too slick. I'm suspicious of things that are slick. Because they sound too smooth, too slick, you find out 10 years later there was something wrong with it. And so I was suspicious of this. They came up with the three dimensions of spiritual leadership. They called it servant, steward, shepherd. And you're a servant of people, you're a steward of a vision or a mission, and you're the shepherd of the people that God gives you to carry out that mission. And I thought, too slick. But the years have gone on by, and I've decided they're right. But I got a couple of definite opinions here. You know, aren't you entitled to some at a certain age, whether they're right or not? And some people too polite to debate with you about them. But I just want to give a couple of thoughts. There's a lot about servant leadership. I think we've got to amend that and correct that a little bit. The servant of people. I think we have to get in our backbone that we are not primarily servants of people. We are primarily servants of Christ. And I want to just give a couple of reasons for this. 2 Corinthians, should be 1 Corinthians 4:1. Let a man so account of us as of the ministers of Christ, as stewards of the mysteries of God. Moreover, it's required in stewards that a man be found faithful. Now, I want something before that. That's my next 2 points. First one is servants. I say that we're primarily servants of Christ, not primarily servants of people. 1 Corinthians 9:19, remember, Paul said, though I be free from all men, yet have I made myself servant at all. Seems to me we have to be free of people in our spirit before we can truly serve them without resentment, being a sycophant, We're servants of Christ. Doss Trotman was my mentor. I won't go into how I met him, but he invited me to work with him, the Navigators, and that meant I got a letter from him saying, I'd like you to come to work with me here and join me in the Navigators. And there wasn't much besides him and a couple other people. There'd be no salary. You'll live with our family, and we'll just share and share alike. And I prayed about it, decided I'd do that. So I went to work in our little office. I was all of NAB Press and the shipping department all by myself. And one day I was back there printing the return addresses on envelopes on a hand-fed press. Doss came back and he looked through the box to see how I was doing and picked one out. And the thing was crooked. It was cattywampus. What's this, Sandy? And I'll be switched. It was the only one in the box. It was uncanny. I didn't know if God helped him or the devil. Really. Because that would happen. He'd pick out the one thing there was something wrong with. Then I got feeling that, you know, I do 10 to 9 things right, one thing wrong, and what did I hear about? One thing that was wrong. And I began to chafe under that. Then I memorized Lamentations 3:27. It is good for a man to bear the yoke in his youth. And that lasted about 2 days, and that wore off. And so some months later, we had a conference in a conference grounds out in California, a place called Hume Lake. And I got out on a big boulder by the lake one afternoon, and I said, Lord, I'd like to leave. I'm tired of this. I don't have to be here. Then as I wrestled through it that afternoon, I surrendered. I said, well, Lord, I'll do whatever you say. I just like to know what you want me to do. And then through a series of scriptures, he led me to something that indicated that I ought to be willing to be Dawson's servant. And that afternoon, I said, okay, Lord, I will. I'll do that for your sake. I'll be his servant. If it means shining his shoes. And you know, that set me free from him to serve him without resentment or without being, as I say, a sycophant on the other hand. Though I be free from all men, yet have I made myself servant unto all. You got to get free. And then, of course, that's where 2 Corinthians 4:5 comes in, doesn't it? For we preach not ourselves, but Christ Jesus the Lord, and ourselves your servants. What's the rest of it? For Jesus' sake. Yeah. Makes quite a difference. You know, it's a very... Who has the... anybody have an NIV with them? Okay, would you turn in your NIV to 2 Samuel 3... 38, 39. Here's King David. What a mighty man. Warrior. Tough and tender if there ever was. Two of his staff, two of his right-hand men, his team, Joab and Abishai, killed Abner. Remember that? You remember what David said about that? Read those two verses, would you?
Then the king said to his men, do you not realize that a prince and a great man has fallen in Israel this day? And today, though I am the anointed king, I am weak, and these sons of Zeruiah are too strong for me. May the Lord repay the evildoer according to his evil deeds.
He said, here I am, I'm the king. And these two men are my team, my sister's boys, my nephews. They're too much for me. They're too much. Here's this mighty king, strong man, Two guys on his staff are too much for him. But then what did he do? He turned them over to the Lord. You ever find yourself in a mental argument with any of your staff members? You get up in the morning and you're shaving and you got in a mental argument. You say something, they say something back, and there's nobody there but you. And sometimes you get a little scared of me. You've ever been scared of your own people? Or what about your congregation? So it's very interesting when Paul's giving his testimony, Acts 26:17, the Lord said, I'll deliver you from the people to whom now I send you. Isn't that interesting? I'll deliver you from the people to whom now I send you. Well, we may need deliverance from, in our spirit from our own congregations and get fearful. That's why I think it's so important that we have it clear and remind ourselves, gentlemen, that we are first and foremost servants of Christ. Then we serve people for Jesus' sake. Really gives us it puts a little steel in the backbone and still keeps warmth in the heart. So we're servants of Christ. Then we're stewards of a mission. A God-given task, aren't we? You know, I just quickly looked up. So much is said about mission statements. The more books I read about what a mission statement ought to be, the more confused I get. But I do have some here. You know, remember what God said to Moses? He said, come now, therefore, and I will send you to Pharaoh that you may bring forth my people, the children of Israel, out of Egypt. That's your job. He didn't go into detail about the 10 plagues. Or the Red Sea, or the wandering in the wilderness, or the giving the law. I mean, there's a lot more involved in that simple essence of a mission statement. But the statement itself was simple. Or Joshua, remember? Deuteronomy 3:28. His mission statement. But charge Joshua and encourage him and strengthen him. Why? For he shall go over before this people, and he shall cause them to inherit the land which you shall see. Not complicated. The statement, a lot of it was involved. It was rather clear. And you can go on through. I don't have to do it for you. Or just take Matthew 28:19. The imperative is what? Make disciples. Navigator income that takes to float the navigators worldwide this year, I'm told, is $85 million. And I can tell you in two words what that's all about. It's to multiply laborers. And to do it in every nation. Just a handful. And if it's not doing that, we need to seriously question whatever it is we're doing. It doesn't contribute toward that mission. Because that's our calling. And those who know me know that I'm kind of a nut on sticking with what God called you to do. In fact, it's not that I'm a nut, it's that God's had me on a choke chain. Like you do when you're training a dog. And it seemed like whenever I'd kind of get away from what I was doing at first, that he just sort of yank on, I go, gulp, and I said, now, Lauren, I gave you a job and I intend you to stick with it. For instance, I never was one of, you know, the other Christian organization, the navigators were looked on as being leaderless. There's an anonymous leader there because he didn't show up much outside the navigators. It bothered me once in a while that I realized I was on that choke chain. Probably God thought, that's all you can handle. I intend you to do that. So I stuck with that. So we are servants of Christ, spiritual leaders, and stewards of a mission God gives us, a task. Then the shepherds of people that God gives us to carry out the task. I was telling some of our staff yesterday that thanks to Jack Mayhall, who was here giving one of the workshops, I read a lot of books on management, leadership. I think the greatest single statement on leadership that I have ever come across, you know, is Psalm 78:72. And, of course, you know that psalm tells what a tough job David had. This rebellious people and all the rest. And how God chose him. And then it says of him, so he fed them according to the integrity of his heart and guided them by the skillfulness of his hand. Have you ever had it raised by some of your people? You know, which comes first? Pardon me. Which comes first? The person or the task? Has that ever reared its head? I know in our work a lot. Well, we're, in this part of the world, we're person-oriented. Sometimes in contrast, you Americans, you know, you're task-oriented. Well, what should we be? Person first or task first? Well, I'll apologize to the tape people here, but do both at once. Here's a little grid that I came across once. I think somebody at the University of Illinois did this. On this side, you have the person. Here's the task. Okay, which comes first, the person or the task, was the question. Well, it depends on what you're doing, right? If you're fighting a fire, it's going to be low on the person and high on the task, don't you suppose? If you're at the country club or the party, it's going to be very high on the person and probably lower than on the task. So it depends on what you're doing at the time. Oh, let's see, well, our company, we're person-oriented. Well, you can be the nicest guys that ever went out of business. Oh, we're task-oriented here, I mean. Well, you can be the most task-oriented, temporarily successful outfit that kept on losing its employees. So somehow or other, it's got to be out here in the middle. As an overall average, doesn't it? Now look at Psalm 78:72. So he fed them according to the integrity of his heart, and he guided them by the skillfulness of his hands. That's what leaders do, right? He fed them according to the integrity. Now I realize it's not new to you. Of his heart. And guided them by the skillfulness . So what are the requisites? Integrity and skill, character and competence. He fed them according to the integrity of his heart and guided them by the skillfulness of his hands. And there we have the tools: heart and hand. And it sure helps to answer this question about shepherding as it relates to the person and the tasks. So, we're servants of Christ, stewards of a mission, and shepherds of the people that God gives us in the carrying out of that mission. I think the guys came up with a pretty solid three dimensions there. So I just wanted to share something with you as a little tone setter for our talk. But we want to talk. This is not a lecture anymore. And about this or anything else And if you ask, if you, you can say, I mean, this is not, I'm not the answer man. I'd be glad to ask questions. You can say things, share something you learned. This is that kind of a thing, okay? And we're going to take exactly 1 hour. We've got another half hour to go. So what do you want to talk about?
Lord, I find myself feeling drawn to one or the other of those two images many times. I neglect paperwork in order to be with people, or I neglect people in order to get the management and administrative stuff done. Is there a clue that you can give us on how to bring those two into the better integration? I know that when I'm doing my job in administration, I am caring for people in a sense, because I'm taking care of ministries that will take care of people. And I know that when I'm directly involved with people, whether it be in counseling or discipleship, I'm doing the work of the ministry that God has given me to do. So I don't regret that at all. But I do find myself sometimes feeling disconnected, because I find myself sometimes saying, well, I need to be somewhere else. And I'd like to achieve greater integration in those two, just like you described there.
Well, can this be a frontal lobe, top of the head thing? So I don't like this, you know, well, it's all fine, but we can reuse the tape. This is not a prepared talk. But I have a couple thoughts on that. You said something that's very interesting. When you're doing the paperwork, you think you ought to be with people. When you're with people, you're thinking about paperwork. And so you're not 100% either place. That can be a problem. And, you know, it's so often in life, we're not all there wherever we are. We're thinking about where we should have done that, or we ought to be over here. It's kind of like you feel like I need to get off somewhere. And while you're with people, you feel, oh, man, I need to get off somewhere. You get off somewhere, and you feel guilty. You ought to be back with the people. So you're not either place 100%, and you're not doing well on either job. I was with the Billy Graham team for about 7 years. And I noticed something about Billy Graham. When he's with you, he's all there. But when he's gone, he's gone. I mean, you can't find hide nor hair of him. So I tried to learn to be all there. If I'm on paperwork, be all there, not thinking about the people. Do it. Now, this is a little personal testimony. I got here, got in the room, got down on my knees, and just dedicated myself to the Lord to be all here while I'm here. So I'm not thinking of the house I'm trying to sell back there, except at this split second I thought of it, or something else I'm going to, but to be all here. And one intense hour will do more than dreamy years, especially when it comes to that paperwork. So I think that's one thing. It's got to be done, okay? This is the time I set aside for it. I'm going to be all there. That's one thing. Then I think just beyond that, then you learn little tricks of the trade, how to handle that paperwork. And I found it for me to just allocate a certain amount of time, because it helps me to focus. And sometimes I get out of the car and walk. I still maintain an office 3 days a week at Glen Eyrie. And 1 Peter 1:13, gird up the loins of your mind. Okay, pull yourself together. Walk in there. Tackle the toughest thing you've got. And focus. Then when you're with people, be all with people. Not thinking about what's over on the desk. So that's one thing that helps me. What helps you guys? I'm sure something has popped in your mind. You said, oh, here's something that helps me in this area.
On the balance on those, this window of time, I've always tried to, let's say the people are the priority, then their availability becomes a priority, and set the paperwork and all the must-do stuff during hours that they're not available and I'm not available. You know, even just structure the time to do the project instead of plowing away at paperwork at a time when you know there's availability with team or your associates in the church. So that doesn't seem like a big thing, but it really is as far as thinking on time structure and windows. Mm-hmm. I never structure time paperwork when I know the only time I have is with my family, let's say they're visiting on a weekend. I just never do that.
Mm-hmm. Yes, right here first.
Yeah, we all experience the same thing, and I actually tend to be more task-oriented, and so there happens to be a deacon in our church that, I mean, I consider him kind of a lay pastor, you know what I mean, in spiritual leadership in our church, and so he is real good at the person stuff, and so to help me be accountable, even though we're in and out of town makes it a little tougher, but try to do it where, so I accomplish the person part. I'm accountable to Ralph, and you know, Ralph, you set up the appointments of what I need to do. You pick me up at 11 o'clock. You take me with you, and then I do leave everything else behind. And I've got that help of someone that's the mentoring process that's his strength, and so I get to learn from that process. And as we talk about the people that we're visiting, that also helps me get my mind off of the paperwork stuff that I left sitting on the desk.
John?
I try what Joe mentioned, and the people usually aren't all that available starting around 8, 9, 10, 11 o'clock at night. And so I tried to do, here I was, you know, so day after day, here I was. So I run into a snag because I lengthen my days out about 14 hours, and I get tired. So,
and your wife was available. Helen was available.
Well, I think, too, and here we could get in more detail, there are little tricks of the trade on that paperwork business. I read it in some books, they never handle a piece of paper twice. I say, unless it goes in the wastebasket, always handle a piece of paper twice. Otherwise, the morning mail determines my priorities.
Right.
So the first thing I do when I go through whatever memos or mail is there is I put a priority on the top and file it in the right priority. Then I go to the top priorities. Otherwise, my day is being run by what happens to show up. And I personally don't like that. Just, you know, you've got little tricks, too, that you do, so. But that's one for me.
Jim Downing said one time, he lets it file up for a week, and then if he doesn't think about it after, he broke all the tricks. Doesn't have been that
far. Well, yeah. There's a weakness if you do what I said with letters. The longer you wait to answer the letter, the longer the answer has to be. That's another thing. Oh, well. Okay, another question. Or statement. Yes?
Reference in 1 Peter 3, Lord.
1:13.
1:13.
Well, I better be sure. You know, it's kind of like, did you turn off the stove? Well, now that you ask, I don't know. let me see. I saw a cartoon where people, the whole family going camping, they had stuff on top of the car and everywhere, and the wife says, I'm not sure I turned off the stove. He said, that's okay, we'll check it at the grounds. I think we brought it. 1:13. Yes?
What verse was it when you said, I'll deliver you from the people to whom I'll send you?
Oh, Acts 26:17. I thought, remember they hit me. That's interesting, isn't it?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Could you elaborate on that verse? It sure sounds like an oxymoron.
Yeah, whatever that is. Which? Where is the emphasis? On the first part of that word or the second part of the word? Joe. Well, we find out, of course, for Paul, that was a big promise because of the where does all his trouble come from? Everywhere he went, the Jews chased him from one town to the other. And but I think also I have seen in lesser physical danger, but men who've been afraid of their congregation, especially in a strong congregational form of government where you've got some strong movements afoot, there's you need to call on the Lord to deliver you from the very people you came to serve, or some of them.
In order to be free to serve
them, that's right. Because then I think it frees you to be a leader and yet not a lord or a boss, but you can still lead. But it frees you up to, and you're not tight and you're not like this, you know. It helps you be more open-handed and still lead.
And I think
that's, of course, that's an art, not a science, yes?
But verse 18 goes on to explain, you know, his whole purpose is to open their eyes and turn them from darkness, you know. And I think in a congregational setting, that's the same thing. Even if you, you know, we've got to remember what we're sent there to do,
mm-hmm.
you know, to open their eyes, to equip and teach them, not to make them into what we may wish them to be from time to time. And because that's what the rest of that begins to talk about.
Okay.
Or can you talk about the seductive side of that, not just the affliction of people, but the seduction of people in their praise, in stroking your ego, in setting yourself free from the people who are really going to strictly validate you and being drawn to them, being drawn to their accolades, being drawn to your agenda versus the agenda that God sets
forth? I don't know if I can answer that or understand that in a setting that you as a pastor have, because in my setting it was more organizational. It was, you know, I mean, we had a hierarchy. And I think it's a little different setup than you have. Maybe you could answer for yourself there.
Well, I don't know that I have the answer. I probably can articulate the struggle. I think we're all seduced by praise and we're seduced by our own imaginations of glory and fame, influence. And to be free from men, as I see it, not only works to be free from their criticism and their accusation, but also to be free from the seduction that might draw us to invest abnormal amounts of energy only in the people that bring us, or only in those activities that bring us more personal accolades. To be set free not only from the critics, but also from the people who look at my critics.
Well, I find that for me, I think the greatest distraction by far are my critics, to the point where I could get obsessed with it sometimes. Bill Gothard, I went to one of his seminars, maybe you heard him say, if you're in conflict with somebody, you cannot leave them emotionally. And I can give you an illustration here. Earlier in my career, after I'd been president maybe 3 years, somewhat notable Christian decided that I was totally unsuited for my job. As I look back now, I think they might have been right. But but the point was that I was cruel, I was underhanded, and tried to get me ousted. Well, it bothered me to the point that it was an obsession. I'd wake up at night with it. I remember I came home from a trip and my wife and I were in the kitchen sipping tea and I was loose as a goose. I was relaxed as could be. And she said, so-and-so is in town, and she named this person, and I could just feel my stomach tighten up in a knot. And I couldn't shake it. And finally one day I told the guys in my team about what was happening and asked that they pray for me. And Jim Downing prayed for me. And the other guy saying amen. And you know, it was like a balloon that was this big. And it was dramatic. The air just went right out of that balloon. And it came down to sight. It didn't disappear because it was still a problem. But it wasn't this big. It was this big. But sometimes it gets so much that you know that it's distorted, but you can't seem to shake it or get loose from it. And I think too, you have to resist the devil here, because he distorts. So if you ever run into something like that, well, you call Jim Downing and get him to pray for you. But to me, that's been my greatest problem. And on the accolade part, what ones I might have gotten, I goof so much. But there's hardly a night, like when I'm speaking here, hardly a day I go to bed at night and there's something I wish I hadn't said. Or that I did say, or didn't say I wish I had. Don't know if that strikes you, but that seems to kind of help me on that end of things.
On this comment that he just now made, what I heard Corey Ten Boom say, I think it was on the Billy Graham when they gave her great honor, brought out this monstrous bouquet. She graciously said, no, thank you, thank you. She turned to Billy and she said, as long as I remember on the inside, Lord, they meant that for you. Because she says, and then the opposite, the light side of that is when somebody, you try to give them a compliment, and say, oh, it wasn't me, it was the Lord. Just look them in the eye and say, no, it wasn't that good.
Somebody asked me once, who keeps you humble? I said, you ever met my family? They're not in awe of me whatsoever. Oh, that's right.
A.W. Tozer wrote a little essay called Five Vows for Spiritual Power, and it's published in a little booklet. It's really worth getting. It's worth getting and giving away.
Five vows
for spiritual power, and it relates to this subject. I can't quote them all.
Can you remember one of them?
Own nothing.
Own nothing.
Is that before taxes or after taxes?
Is that before or after taxes? You know, have you ever had people wonder, do you tithe on the gross or on the net? I heard a pilot, maybe you heard this answer, but say, well, it depends if you want to be blessed on the gross or on the net. Now, that was a good answer. What were you saying, Joe?
Well, you know, this is elementary, I know, but I'm memorizing the Sermon on the Mount, rememorizing it, and this thing about reconciliation, like this fellow that gave me the knot in the stomach, I think we've all had those kind of guys. This whole exercise of leaving my gift at the altar, even if you know the other guy has a problem, and first being reconciled with him, and then come and offer thy gift. And I thought, that is so simple, it just about goes over my head. And I was thinking, if everybody did this before they did all their activities and all their deals, probably the first Sunday we'd have empty churches in America. Everybody would be getting reconciled before they went back to the Lord. But this thing has changed my life. And it's an old truth. An old truth.
We tend to move away from the people that cause us grief. We avoid them instead of moving toward them.
I moved 3,000 miles away. Found out he was transferred to my area.
Why are we doing what we're doing in Colossians 3:23?
Which is?
Oh, just the idea of whatever you have time to do is to the Lord, not the man. Remember who you're serving.
Yeah.
And that kind of helps me. Well, they're not pleased, but then it's anyway, putting that all together.
Mm-hmm.
What do you do when reconciliation is a two-way street? It takes both people to do that. What do you do when the person that is at odds with you and that creates this tension and conflict, does it want to be reconciled? And you bear that.
Well, I'm adding up again on that. And speaking in some marriage conferences that my wife and I are leading, you must remember that forgiveness is a choice. Whether you feel like it or whether the other person has asked, it does not prevent you from forgiving and moving on.
I could turn this into a... I better back off of this one. I'll just tell you, I'm having trouble. I may as well out with it. And whatever happens, happens. I know we ought to have a forgiving spirit. But I can't get around Luke 17:3. Your brother sins against you, rebuke him. And if he repent, forgive him. Now I read the books and say, well, you forgive whether or not they repent. What do you do about Luke 17:3? So I've been wondering about this. I think what some of them are saying is don't retaliate. Of course not, you're not to retaliate. But when do you give up your anger, drop the charges, and restore the fellowship? Seems to me there's got to be some repentance and forgiveness. Otherwise, to me, it's a little shallow, it's a little easy. But I do know there's great disagreement on this particular point. I'm just telling you what I've been wrestling with. And it's not academic. This is real to life for me.
I gotta stand up.
Good. Stand up and share with us.
I've been wrestling with forgiveness for a long time and end up drawing a diagram that looks like a peace sign with three parts to it. And in order for forgiveness to occur, first thing that has to happen is you got to call it sin. They say that's obvious, except we don't call it sin because we don't want to acknowledge that we've been hit. And so we call it odd, and we'll call it anything except sin so that we don't have to deal with it. But for forgiveness to work, as I understand biblically, the first thing I have to do is I have to give up the pursuit of personal vengeance. And so I give that up. The second thing that I must do is that I must bring the situation before the judge. So I come before the judge with this wrong and say, God, it's yours, it's your problem. And then I leave it with the judge. Now, my definition of forgiveness is restoring the relationship to where it was before the offense occurred. Now the thing is that I can be blameless with God, as in I've given up my pursuit of personal vengeance, I've left it with the judge, and I can walk on blameless and not have a restored relationship until the other repents.
That's right.
And I can go the other way around. And so I walk free because I'm not holding a grudge. Or I walk free because I've forgiven because I was the one that offended. See, and I know in my life, I know people who are holding grudges against me that are affecting their lives 20 years later. I can't do anything about it, but I know I'm free.
But it breaks your heart. I
remember 1 Corinthians 9, 2 Corinthians 9, that godly sorrow works repentance. That there is a godly sorrow that never goes away, that protects me from making the same mistake again, that guards me. But man, I live with godly sorrow. But what I've got to do is I've got to change and understand, because I was living with a great deal of what I saw was guilt. And God helped me understand that it was godly sorrow. It was my protection without losing the fact that there were some relationships that were hurt and destroyed. I can live with godly sorrow because that's biblical and that's godly. But if I live with a grudge, if I live with bitterness, then I'm in sin whether I sin. That's why I make the separation.
Okay, good, thank you. Well, I would imagine that all the more for you men in your ministry that God's given you, this is a continuous kind of thing among members of the congregation and their other people. This whole matter of reconciliation, forgiveness, I imagine that's basic. Thank you for that. But it's... We don't want to heal the hurt of the daughter of our people slightly, saying peace, peace, when there is no peace. We want to, so there is real freedom here down inside. Well, look, we've got 5 minutes. You might like to take another topic here for a few moments. Thank you for that.
Could you just comment on one thing? Is this a worldly philosophy, forgive and forget, or is it scriptural? I believe in forgiveness, but I have a hard time forgetting situations that really took me to soul. Could you talk about forgetting it? You're supposed to forget those things which are behind it. That's a tough one, to forget that.
Go ahead.
Remember the illustration. I took it to the judge and I left it with the judge. I say forgiving is remembering. Remembering that I left it with the judge. I've got to remember that I left it with the judge. I've got to remember that I did. I walked in obedience. And that's the start of the healing process. See, when you've got an abscess inside you, the surgery required to take it out. You don't jump off the table and go run a marathon. But the forgiveness is the process that allows the healing to begin.
So time I don't know, forgetting.
So, except 20 years later, I still remember. But I better remember that I left it with the judge, or I go back into a forgiveness cycle again. So I say forgiveness is remembering that I have willed by God's grace to do something with it. I've left it with the judge, and it's in his hands, and it's not mine to worry.
Thank you. Thank you very much. Well, that gives us 3.5 minutes.
I have another question about leadership if somebody else does, and I've already asked them.
Well, nobody else's hand went up, so you're on.
When you're CEO of an organization like the Navigators, obviously part of your task is to relentlessly communicate the vision and keep people focused on the main thing.
That's right.
What are some ways that you found effective to do that?
Well, my job description for myself for 30 years was, number one, set, clarify, and maintain the aim and purpose of the Navigators. And I remember talking with Chuck Swindoll about this, thinking about his church. He said, you are forever, in different ways, explaining what we're about and why. And so you're looking for stories, particularly stories that you can tell, that illustrate in various ways. So it just doesn't become bored, just a repeating of a certain statement, but that you're constantly forever calling attention to it, number one, and number two, that you are evaluating decisions being made as to what you're going to do, where and when, in the light of that mission. So that it's not something that's in the drawer or that sounds good, but actually affects what happens at the church council or wherever as you are making things. And I had suggested to our pastor that they put it on the bulletin every Sunday, and the top of all the agenda for every church council, they put the statement of the mission. So they always can say, well, now, how does what we're talking about, how's that forward what we feel God has called us to do? So it becomes part and parcel. And some churches, as you know, have very cleverly added with key words and even the banners, you know, on the church, and said in good ways, that just to remind us of what we're about. What about you?
Same thing. I have a church that changed their name to reflect their vision.
Mm-hmm.
They were a tiny church in a tiny town in the San Joaquin Valley, and it was named after that tiny little town. And the vision was to spread out to the whole valley, so they changed their name to the Big Valley Church, so that even their name always reflected to in everything that they did that their vision was to reach that whole place.
Was that Big Valley Grace Community?
You bet.
I've been there. That's quite a church. Well, gentlemen, nice to have an hour with you.